ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We've always been very bad at predicting the future. Don't believe me? Well, 67 years ago, the ABC asked Australians to do just that, and...
You all commute daily and hourly so fast through space in your private flying saucers...
Global peace and international harmony will be completely attained by the year 2000.
Yeah, still waiting on that world peace. I'm Matt Bevan, and from if you're listening, this is Black Swans, a series about the events we can't see coming, no matter how hard we try. It's available now on ABC Listen.
In 2022, the Albanese government committed to ending violence against women in a generation. That's a vision shared by all states and territories. And while the issue was back on the national agenda in 2024, after a spike in intimate partner homicides, key recommendations from a rapid review have since gathered dust. Today, on a special episode of Politics Now, Claudia Long on what more we need to do and why we can't afford to wait. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Claudia Long.
Claudia, thanks for joining me for a special episode to look at this issue, which I think, you know, is kind of a perennial, never-ending issue. Wish it wasn't thus, but it is. And that's, of course, violence against women and children. It's a difficult topic, but I think also very, very achievable to talk about with some obvious things that could happen. It has been in the spotlight really since, well, forever, but very much in terms of the political agenda, even since the Morrison government. But it has very much gathered traction under the Albanese government. Just give me a sense of where we're at.
It's really been 10 years since the Australian government declared gendered violence a national crisis, PK, and you're exactly right. This was really starting to politically, I think, come to the fore again. You know, we saw when there were high profile, for lack of frankly a better term, individual homicides of women, that this would pop back in, frankly, to the public consciousness. I'm thinking of women who were murdered, like Jill Maher and Eurydice Dixon.
People in Melbourne are grieving at the death of Eurydice Dixon. Melbourne's full of strong, funny women like Eurydice, and this has hit us hard. Prime Minister, do you agree that whatever we're collectively doing as a country now to change men's behaviour, we need to do more?
Our hearts go out to Eurydice's family. Women must be safe everywhere. On the street, walking through a park, in their homes, at work.
And we would often see politicians say, well, this must stop and we have to do better and we have to do more to protect women. But those were really sort of individual spikes, I guess, or blips on the political agenda, to be frank. And so under the Albanese government in 2022, they joined their state and territory counterparts and they made this pledge to end violence against women and children within a generation.
I had the enormous privilege 2 weeks ago of launching the second ever 10-year national plan to end violence against women and children. Along with my state and territory counterparts and my colleagues here today, it is the blueprint of how we will work to address family, domestic and sexual violence over the next 10 years.
There had obviously been plans around this before then, but that was obviously quite a substantial pledge. As for the specifics of that, though, like, it's still sort of unclear exactly what the details of that are. It's kind of more of an idea rather than a specific date, I guess, if you could put it that way. Mm. And this blueprint outlined these four key areas for investment.
By addressing the underlying drivers to prevent violence before it occurs, to intervene early and prevent further escalation, to respond appropriately when violence is used, and to support the recovery and healing of victim survivors in ways which put them at the centre.
And so prevention and early intervention sound similar. They're actually kind of different. So one is stopping violence from even occurring in the first place. One is intervening as early as possible when violence has begun to occur. And they're related, but they are notably quite different. And in the time since that's been announced, there have been, once again, when there was a spike in homicides, and that's been dropping over the past couple of decades, that's the trend. But in 2024, we saw, unfortunately, a spike in these homicides. And so that then led to a national cabinet meeting. There was an emergency meeting that was convened to deal with this issue.
Today, we're announcing a new $4.7 billion has been established for gender-based violence and frontline legal services through new agreements between the Commonwealth and the states and territories. This is on top of the already.
There was a rapid review that came out of that about how to best prevent violence against women and children. And now the states, territories and the Commonwealth government are acting, or in some cases not acting, on the recommendations of that review. And so that's sort of where we're at now, PK.
And just put it in some historical context. I think we have come a really long way where even that our national leaders think it's their responsibility to talk about. I've watched gendered violence never be talked about publicly, right, and never be given a focus from our federal politicians or our state politicians. And now it's very squarely in their remit as an area of national priority. And, I mean, I've written pieces, for instance, about how, you know, some people would like us to treat it like terrorism, right, like to give it the status of a very significant national emergency. Just kind of in terms of where you think the politicians are at, and obviously there's different politicians with different views, but broadly, are we there yet? Are they treating it that way? Has there been the focus, in your view, that demonstrates that that shift has been fully and comprehensively been made?
I would say with some of them, yes. And I completely agree with what you're saying, that really, even in the last 7 or so years that I've been working in this building, there's been a noticeable shift in how much they talk about this issue. And that is really notable and it's worth marking. In terms of where the government and opposition and individual politicians are at on this issue, it really does vary from person to person. And I think the ministers who are in charge of this, and that's Social Services Minister Tanya Plibersek, but also Assistant Minister Jed Carney, it's very clear that they take this extremely seriously. And for them, this is definitely one of their priorities. In terms of the attitude to violence against women in other portfolios, because PK, this is always mentioned as something that needs a whole of government response, right? In 2025, we did a story about learner drivers who were being sexually assaulted or harassed, they alleged, by their driving instructors. So obviously that crosses into the domain of transport, potentially, and also Attorney General's department and all sorts of things. And Attorney General's is a really interesting one, actually, in this domain as well, because the Australian Law Reform Commission made a whole bunch of recommendations about how to make the legal system better for survivors of sexual violence. And that's something that is in the works, but obviously requires the collaboration of the states and territories to get done in a lot of ways. And so that's really the intractable thing here, I think, PK, is even if there's individuals that really do passionately care about this issue and sometimes have lived experience of it as well, I might add, it is a hard one to tackle on a number of levels because you have to often coordinate not only the federal government. And I think, you know, as we observe quite often, PK, getting money out of the federal government can be like getting blood out of a stone for a lot of ministers. But you also have to coordinate with all of these different jurisdictions in the states and territories. And they often have differing views, they often have differing priorities, and they often have differing ways that they want to spend their money. And that is where I think a lot of this tends to get held up a little bit. And this is something that the Domestic Family and Sexual Violence Commissioner, Michaela Cronin, has noted as well. So she handed her yearly report card to Parliament a couple of months ago. And one of the things she suggested is this national watchdog to essentially coordinate and track where everybody is at on addressing this issue, to track where the money's going.
I mean, you've always got to balance the fact that getting 8 jurisdictions to be focused on implementing, as you've said, thousands of recommendations with pretty significant consistency across what the themes are, that there will be issues around that. What one of the recommendations we've made is that there needs to be a national body that really drives that implementation.
And also, who's following the recommendations of not only the rapid review, but also the many, many, many reviews and coronial inquests that have happened around this issue, where in her view, a lot of those recommendations just gather dust. And she actually detailed that in this report. Her team went back through, you know, hundreds and hundreds of these recommendations dating back, I think, over the past decade and a half. And many of them, while similar, had not been addressed. And so she's calling for that kind of national watchdog to keep everybody on track, because I think that's where these problems start to creep in from a policy point of view, is just the lack of coordination there and also you know, if you talk to people who work in frontline services, the lack of funding and the lack of money, in their view, that makes doing their jobs incredibly difficult, particularly as demand for their services PK is continuing to increase.
So what's been the government's response to this idea, the watchdog? And like, are they pushing this along? Is there enthusiasm to try and get this moving?
Well, not yet publicly. We have put questions on this issue to them, but they don't seem to be prioritising that approach at the moment. Their answer is normally that they're spending more on this issue than any government in history, that they're paying, you know, a great deal of attention to it, that it is integral in their decision-making across a number of portfolios. And they have made progress in some areas too, to give them credit where it's due. So, for instance, there's been a review or an audit of how government systems might be used by perpetrators to further their abuse. And that has been something that is within the federal government's purview that they've been able to look at and begin making those changes. So it doesn't seem to be on the agenda for them at the moment, but 2026 is going to be an interesting year to watch this, because that's what people in the sector are telling us is going to be their year to focus on trying to get more resources from the government, because the unfortunate thing about this is that demand is growing. It's not going away. It's not shrinking. And as more people too, when we talk about this more, PK, in the media, but also when people become perhaps more aware through awareness campaigns and things like that, that they have been subjected to abuse or they might need help, more people come forward. And so there is this need for more resourcing, and it is across so many different groups and organisations and services at a state level, at a federal level. It's far enough away from the next election, and they're early enough in the term that they're hoping that they can get more money and funding to support services. They're a bit worried that once we get beyond 2026, the government's going to need to start tightening their belt, preparing for the next election, and it's going to fall off the radar again.
And all of this happens at the same time as a sort of global trend, I think it's fair to say, you know, the rise of the so-called manosphere. And at the same time, I just want to inject this in, a bit of a rethink about some of the ways that we've been framing this issue. And there's been a big push to kind of try and bring men in rather than make them feel like they're not part of this conversation or that it's adversarial. Do you think both these things are true?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, we know from the statistics that young men, and not just young men, but men are a key part of this problem. We're mainly talking about men's violence against women overwhelmingly. And when it comes to young men, PK, I think this idea about the manosphere is something that is definitely on the government's mind, because it is deeply concerning, frankly. We're seeing things, for instance, like rates of sexual violence among young people to one another increasing, which really is a terrible thing in and of itself. It's also potentially a bad sign, and we don't necessarily have enough data to say either way yet. But when you consider that these are the young people who are the ones getting the consent education, they're the ones who have often been the target of these awareness campaigns, but these numbers are still going up, and the question is why? And is it the young people who've been getting these campaigns and education? Is it other young people who perhaps haven't been reached yet? We don't know necessarily. So that is going to be one to watch. And also, even younger, because we're talking about women and children, I think we also have to talk about childcare and sexual violence against babies and children in childcare. And this is another thing that is going to be something that the government urgently needs to address. This has been exposed by Four Corners in 2025. We actually asked Jess Walsh, she is the early education minister, whether the government would undertake an independent review of childcare standards. That was recommended by the Productivity Commission. And those standards, they include a lot of things, but they also include safety rules. And she wouldn't say either way.
Well, we're focused on the measures that will keep children safe today. We're working our way through the Productivity Commission findings. We're implementing those findings. We're responding
in Senate estimates, she said firmly, that's not on the government's agenda. So they're still going to be under pressure, I think, to do that in 2026. Now, they argue that they're doing more immediate things. You know, we've seen the childcare worker pay rise, for instance, and some other moves around safety, including CCTV. But that is the other element of this, is young people and children, who Michaela Cronin, the commissioner, said need to be a focus of the government in their own right, not just in how they relate to primarily their mothers or carers who might be victims and survivors of abuse as well. So there's a lot of plates spinning in this space, PK, and I think this comes back to what we were talking about before. One of the reasons this is such a thorny problem facing the government and governments at all levels in all jurisdictions is the amount of coordination that's required, because so much of this is what we call cross-portfolio decision-making.
Yeah, the whole of government. I mean, you can see it's very different, but I think you can see some similarities with, for instance, Indigenous affairs, right, where that's a whole of government approach that's needed as well. And sometimes, while that sounds good, that every minister is responsible, I have found that it also means no minister is ultimately responsible, Claudia. And it's a vexed tension area for me, because as soon as you kind of have every different, you know, agency and every different department working on it, and you should, I'm not suggesting, I'm just to be very clear that, you know, the education department shouldn't be working on it or whatever, and that there shouldn't be that approach. But equally, kind of, who has to execute? Now, in this case, back to women, we have a Minister for Women in Katie Gallagher, who I think is extremely committed to the area. And even in promising to end violence in a generation, you know, that's a big thing, because it is a systemic, societal, deep-rooted issue. And so the idea that a government can come in and legislate it away or something is just not true. So it's a big thing that they're promising. Good that they're promising, but who ultimately takes charge? Like, that's the vexed thing, isn't it?
Exactly. I think you've summed it up quite well, because, yeah, when everybody's responsible, I think anybody who has ever worked under a flat management structure can attest no one is responsible.
Yeah.
Because you're right. Like, this does require inherently cross portfolio work. Like, you mentioned Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people before. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women experience violence at far higher rates than their counterparts in the community. And so I think, you know, that's worth noting. And that's an example of why this has to be cross-portfolio work, right? Like, you don't just want somebody coming in with no experience of particular communities. You know, I'd add the disability community to this, for instance, the LGBT community. You don't want people coming in with no experience of a particular community and saying, well, we're going to do what's best for you, and then it not working because they don't have that experience. And so this does need to be cross-portfolio, but you need people spearheading this. And you're completely right. The individual ministers and politicians who are the ones spearheading this, they do take this issue very seriously as individuals. That's very clear in conversations with them and with their staff. The problem can be the mechanisms of how government works, and also sometimes what they do and don't view as their responsibilities. One of the things that I think we hear a lot as political reporters, not just on this issue, you know, I think you could also say this about health and disability, a whole range of things, is the phrase, I think we should get it on a t-shirt, PK, that's a matter for the states. And it's like, is it though? Because the thing about something being a matter for the states is that it can also be a matter for the federal government. And the reason for that is that the federal government can do a number of things. They can coordinate the states and territories, even if they can't control them. They can get them all together. It's what ministerial meetings are for instance, and try and get everybody on the same page, or at least going in the same direction. They can also tie certain things to funding. And we've seen this in education. This is something that Jason Clare, the education minister, has been quite a big proponent of, is tying federal government money to particular policies. And so that is also something they can do. So nothing is ever, you know, and I'm going to tie my flag to the mast here and say, this is a Claudia Long opinion, not necessarily an opinion of my employer, but nothing is ever truly just a matter for the states. It's quite, from a federal policy and politics point of view, there's always a way that the federal government can be involved somehow, even if it isn't direct. So I think that's sort of the thorny political problem at the heart of this issue, is where does the federal government see itself in relation to the states and territories, and how far is it willing to go to try and coordinate or have an influence on them?
I think there's an interesting political dynamic I just want to get your thoughts on at the moment. So we've got a, you know, female Liberal leader in Susan Lee, who I think is leaning into this area a bit more than I've seen other opposition leaders, and they've all been men for the Liberal Party. And actually for Labor too, can I just say, in opposition always. And she has made it a bit of a thing. I mean, she gave a really significant speech in the Parliament, for instance. She said, how do we maintain the rage around these issues?
Today I stand here in our National Parliament and read these names into our national record, as I have done before and will do so again, because these women matter. But we don't need new horrors to remind us here today that violence against women is pervasive and present in every corner of our country. So how do we maintain the rage? How do we cut through? How do we overcome the fatigue? Let us use that hope to drive us, because we must not look...
Clearly, she has her own backstory in relation to coercive control. We don't know all of the details, but she has hinted at it. This is something that matters to her. Does that create a political dynamic? Because you do need some tension in politics where it is likely to put some pressure to make sure that there is delivery here.
I think it could, if the opposition is able to coordinate on that issue. And so what I think that would require is for everybody to be on the same page and united in wanting to push for that to be an issue. And you mentioned that speech that Susan Lee gave, and that is an important thing, you know, in this dynamic. I think the other thing in this dynamic too is that, and this has been written about, I believe, in The Guardian, is that Anthony Albanese also potentially has experience of this issue. It's something he's extremely private about. And so they both, in their past, and we don't know a lot about it, and that is absolutely their right to keep that private as well. Like, they shouldn't have to, you know, potentially put really traumatic moments in their history on display for the nation for them to be taken seriously. So they both have this in their past. And whether or not that becomes part of the debate will be interesting to see. It shouldn't necessarily have to be really clear. But in terms of whether the opposition can put this on the agenda, and, you know, particularly with a female opposition leader who, if she pushes the government on this, it might make it easier in some ways, I think, for women in the community to see themselves a little bit in that too. You know, it's a woman talking about this at one of the highest levels of government and politics. Whether they can make that happen is going to rely on whether they're all on the same page and whether they could coordinate and actually stop infighting and keep the focus on a policy issue rather than on them.
Yeah, I think that's right. The other thing about bipartisanship, and we have had broadly bipartisanship on this issue, right? Like, violence against women comes up. There's, you know, no one's saying don't fund that. They're saying the opposite, right? Like, you know, the pressure is on. I think sometimes bipartisanship, I'm going to say something very controversial, but can operate in a negative way as well. And I remember, and I keep comparing it to Indigenous affairs because I covered it, you know, intensely for years, that I had some Indigenous leaders who had told me at the time, a few years ago, that one of the worst things that had happened is too much bipartisanship. And I'll explain. What it means is there's almost a pact between politics and it doesn't make it on the agenda enough. Sometimes you need a tension where someone's putting pressure on the other side to do more. You know what I'm saying? Rather than we're all together, kumbaya, there's no pushing for more and more and more and more and more focus and attention. You getting my vibes here?
Yes. It can be in that way where conflict can be constructive. You know, conflict of ideas can be constructive because it pushes you to do more, to go further, to focus on this instead of, like you say, if everyone's on the same page, then it sort of becomes a non-story to a lot of, you know, journalists, because we're interested in stuff that's, you know, happening, that's new, where there's ideas being contested. And so if something is seen as the status quo, that sort of fades into the background a lot, because it's like, well, that's just how things are and that's just how we approach this issue. And I think that's a really good point, PK, actually.
I think that we will, at least you and me, focus very much on this. And I know lots of people broadly, I know lots of men are committed to this too, not just women. And it's going to be very much a 2026 focus, I do think. It'll be very interesting to see, though, whether the government has the kind of bandwidth to put the focus on it, because they've obviously got a lot of looming problems. Yeah. And this one, you know, is something that burns under, right, doesn't it? Like, it's, you know, and there's always a spike and a reactivity to that spike, and then a dissipation again. I mean, it's still going on in the community, but in terms of the media's focus, and a discomfort sometimes with talking about it.
The other tricky thing politically is we know that the government is worried about their budget position, PK, but this will require money. This will require more money. And that is, you know, that is the reality, is that, you know, whether it's something like income support, whether it's something like the fleeing violence payment, which is something that, you know, the coalition government trialled, Labor then made permanent, and a lot of people, you know, have been able to benefit from. But there's also people who say, for instance, well, I'm not eligible for that if I'm escaping a violent parent or sibling or carer. That's a pretty good example of where if you extended that payment, which would cost money, but more people would be eligible for it, it could help more people to flee violence. And this is the kind of conundrum and that the government is going to be facing in terms of spending and where their spending priorities are and what their spending priorities are going to be around this issue and where the states and territory spending priorities are and how much they can influence them.
Claudia, thank you for talking to me about this today. I think it's a really important topic, and I think our audience is very passionate about these issues too. So you've been an absolute delight to talk to. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
That's it for Politics Now for today. And if this chat has raised any issues for you, you can contact 1-800-RESPECT National Helpline. That's 1-800-737-732. And other resources are linked in the show notes. And as always, if you have a question for us, you can send one of those questions to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. See you, Claudia.
See you, PK.